Chapter 5. Sometimes people ask me how I got to be so old. It's tough, I tell them. The short answer is to live as best you can while avoiding all the things that will kill you, but that never satisfies anyone. They want specific nuggets of wisdom, like, you probably shouldn't go yachting off the coast of Somalia, or never eat sushi in a restaurant where you're the only customer. But even these sound a bit disappointing. Stay away from the guy who throws lightning bolts, though. That's a classic. Highly recommended. My amulet wouldn't protect me from a bolt of lightning, so I shifted to Tir na n'og before Thor could get himself in range. He'd probably set the forest on fire once I left, just for spite. I remained in Tir na n'og just long enough to recover my cache of clothes, and then I shifted to another fey plane, Ma'mel, and luxuriated in a hot mineral spring. It was partially to recuperate and partially to throw off Hugin and Moonin. They couldn't follow me to the Irish plains, and that was a blessed pint apiece. Another blessed pint was the one served to me by a comely wood nymph in the spring, Govnew's Ma'mel Ale. It's a warty and voluptuous brew, quite mouthy, with a smooth yet grainy foundation and a bodacious, provocative finish that couples a whiff of wanton peaches with the innocence of a virgin. If you can get to Ma'mel, it's free. That's right, there's free beer in Irish paradise. Everyone's jealous. After a few of those, I had my smug on for sure, and I shifted to Pisgah National Forest outside Asheville, North Carolina, to visit Laksha. We arranged by cell phone to meet in Pritchard Park downtown, where we sat on the rocks next to a small waterfall. If she was surprised or disappointed by my appearance, she hid it well. After inquiring about the small blemishes on the apple's surface, she took a bite, and I saw true pleasure illuminate the features of the face she inhabited. Her skin, already beautiful, tightened and smoothed and shone with health. "Satisfied?" I asked. She nodded.
"Very much so. Well done, Mr. O'Sullivan."
"Then I will take my leave," I said, standing up and giving her a short bow. "I'd eat it all up soon, though, because Hugin and Moonin are looking for it. Best of luck growing your own tree of immortality."
"That's it," Laksha frowned. "I get no more civility than that."
"I have kept my word to you, Laksha. Please, judge me by that, nothing more. As for civility, I leave you in far better circumstances than you left me after you slew the Bakkens. And there's much that demands my attention elsewhere. Please excuse me." With that, I turned on my heel and started jogging back to the Pisgah Forest, for while I appreciated Laksha's adherence to her word and her skills as a witch, I had no desire to cultivate a friendship with her. I hadn't been lying about the many demands on my attention. The long soak in the hot springs proved to be an extremely comfortable place in which to confront some uncomfortable facts. There really wasn't anything for me to feel smug about beyond the stark fact that I'd bearded the lion in his den and survived. For now. There was no way that Odin would let the deaths of Sleipnir and the Norn slide. Nor should he. Though I could argue that I'd slain them all in self-defense, the unyielding, inconvenient truth of it was that I had chosen to go to Asgard. No one had forced me. I had made promises and traded one set of problems for another, much larger set. I did not see any way to trade down to something more manageable now, except by abandoning everything I cared about. It used to be so easy for me to run, to care about nothing but myself and the earth underneath my feet. That had been my modus operandi ever since Tahira died. I never stayed anywhere long enough to be bound by commitments, never entangled myself with the lives of others, and told myself it was all about avoiding Angus Oak. That was more true than I realized. What I'd truly been avoiding was love, the strongest binding there is, and the pain that scrapes at your insides when the bond is forcefully broken. It has been more than 5 centuries. I still miss her. She smiles in my dreams sometimes, and I wake up weeping for the loss. When we were married, I did not move without thinking of her first. And now I am in a similar place. I cannot move without thinking of Oberon, as well as my duty to Grañuel. I will not, cannot, abandon them. I saw that my need to defend and protect them had driven my choices in recent months. From killing Angus Oge to making an unwise bargain with Leif so that he would help me dispatch a nasty German coven. Flitish had told me, back at Tony Cabin, that she knew I would have run from Angus Oge again if Oberon hadn't been held hostage. And she was right. Likewise, if de Tochter de Stritten Houses had not killed Perry and tried to kill both Grañuel and me, I would not have called Leif for help and agreed to take him to Asgard. Those had been rash, desperate decisions, not the sort that would most likely allow me to stay alive. But once bound by the ties of love, there is no other choice one can make and remain human. They'd been simple choices at the time that were now making my life tremendously complicated. My immediate safety was an illusion. The consequences would come home eventually like the prodigal son. A karmic debt, Laksha might have said, but with the usurious rates incurred at a payday loan center. It was time for me to leave Arizona. There was an annoying Tempe detective named Kyle Geffert who was convinced I'd had something to do with what the media called the Saturn Massacre. And he was right. Thus far, my lawyers had kept me from suffering long interrogation sessions in a steel-gray room laced with cigarette smoke, but I didn't see how I could avoid it for much longer. The lone Bacchant that had escaped that fiasco left knowing positively that the world's last druid lived in Arizona, and Bacchus would probably be roused by that alone, to say nothing of his reaction if the Norse pantheon had taken my bait and blamed him for my Thanksgiving shenanigans. A group of fanatic Russian demon hunters, who called themselves the Hammers of God, thought I was too cozy with the forces of darkness, despite the fact that I'd probably slain more demons than they had. Rabbi Yosef Bialik would probably return to harass me with a few of his friends, now that he knew I kept company with werewolves and witches. On top of all this, one of my regular customers in the bookshop had asked me last week how I stayed looking so young. It was time to go. The idea of moving wouldn't bother me, except for what I'd have to leave behind. The fish and chips at Rulabula, sipping whiskey with the Widow McDonough, the simple pleasures of being a practicing herbalist, all would be sorely missed. Two, there was a large wasteland to heal around Tony Cabin, the existence of which was at least partly my responsibility, and I wanted more than anything to spend all my time there righting that particular wrong. But I had chains of obligation to throw off first. Proverbial ducks I had to get in a row. After running for most of the last couple days, I surprised myself by asking Oberon as soon as I got home if he'd like to go for a run.
"You're damn skippy, I do," he said.
I'd picked him up from the Widow McDonough's house, where he'd been staying during my absence. The widow wasn't in, which was just as well. If she'd been home, I would have had to sit and chew the fat for a while, and Oberon had been waiting long enough. The widow's cats provided him plenty of entertainment, but she couldn't take him for walks and give him the sort of exercise a very large Irish wolfhound needs. We jogged through the Mitchell Park neighborhood where I lived, and he brought me up to date on what I'd missed.
"The cats are beginning to get used to me," he complained. "They've managed to notice that in all the times I've barked at them and chased them, not once have I killed them. I haven't even bitten them. So now they can't be bothered so much as to raise their hackles at me. It's depressing. No, you know what it is? Emasculating."
I chuckled and spoke aloud as we jogged. I often spoke directly to his mind through the bond we shared, but since no one was around to hear me, I enjoyed making use of my breath.
"Whoa, 5 syllables. Very impressive."
"I deserve a tweet for that."
"Indubitably. And we'll go hunting as soon as I can manage. I'm sorry to hear about your emasculation."
"No, you're not. but this will make you sorry. The widow has a long list of medical problems.
I frowned at him and checked to see if he was joking. She does?
Uh-huh. She explained them to me in detail. Graphically. Sometimes it was even show and tell.
Ooh, that does make me sorry. She's never said anything about them to me.
Well, can't you do anything for her?
I let a few paces go by before I answered. The neighborhood mourning doves were happy and cooing to each other. A stooped old man in Bermuda shorts was trimming down his cloud sage bush for the winter, moving slowly and carefully. He was too preoccupied with his topiary to recognize that I was talking to my dog as we passed. Yes, I could reverse the aging process with immortality, and that would take care of pretty much everything. It repairs cell damage, prevents cancer, increases white blood cells, you name it. But what if I did that for her? What do you think would happen?
She'd feel better, Atticus, and that's what matters.
True, but you're not thinking it through. The widow's getting close to 90 years old if she's not there already. Let's say I put her on an intensive regimen of immortality, and she shed 50 years in 5 weeks. She would look and feel 40 years old, and if I never gave her any tea after that, she could still look forward to living at least another 50 years.
That would be awesome!
No, it wouldn't. People would start asking questions. Everyone would want to know how she did it. Her friends and relatives especially. She's told you about her kids and grandkids, right?
Right.
Well, her oldest son is 67. She'd be younger than him. That would be awkward. Her grandkids would freak out because their grandma didn't look like a sweet old lady anymore. So what does she tell them? This nice druid I know did me a solid?
Well, why not? They couldn't hurt you.
It's not about hurting me. They're going to want to stay young, too. And then their friends and relatives will, and before you know it, the tabloids will get hold of the story and latch on like 7 puppies after 6 teats.
Oh, great big bears. That does sound pretty bad.
And then the government will get involved, because having someone live that long is eventually going to raise flags at the IRS and Social Security Administration. Her driver's license picture won't match her face. All sorts of questions are going to be asked.
But aren't your friends worth that kind of trouble?
The widow by herself would be worth the trouble. But I can't confine it to her. Still, let's say I did. She gets to start life over at 40 while her kids all continue to age and die. Would she thank me for her youth when she's standing over the grave of her son? Or the graves of her grandchildren?
Well, probably not. I see your point.
Good. I've been in that position, Oberon, far too many times. I've buried my children and their children and so on. It carves away a piece of you.
You've never offered them immortality?
Sure I have. It's how I learned all the stuff I just told you. The painful way. And I learned that some people become distanced from humanity, severely troubled and reclusive when they live too long. Sort of like vampires tend to do, only without the blood-sucking. If their minds aren't trained like a druid's, they gradually collect neuroses over time, like sunbathers collect wrinkles. Immortality can't fix batshit insanity.
You had kids who went batshit insane?
Yep, that's why eventually I stopped offering.
Are you going to have any more?
Not soon. Need to be in a place where I can settle down. And this isn't that place. I need to talk to you about that, actually.
About what?
I explained to him that we needed to move out of Tempe. I'll have to go back to Asgard soon, and it'll be a longer trip than the first one. It might be forever, because I might not come back. And if that's what happens, then you need to be good to Mrs. McDonough. But if I do return, we'll be leaving right away.
Where are we going?
I don't know yet.
Any place is good, so long as there's sausage and bitches.
I never thought of it that way, I smiled. But now that you've clarified my thinking, I wonder why they don't list those amenities in real estate ads. It seems criminally negligent.
Human priorities are messed up, Atticus. I've made the observation many times, but nobody cares for the wisdom of hounds.
I care, buddy. I believe you to be remarkably wise.
Then I think it would be wise for you to adopt a French poodle.
I laughed. Perhaps when we are safely settled elsewhere.
Promise?
I cannot promise you, Oberon, I said, regret tinging my voice, and I could tell he was disappointed. But look, it is good to have a dream so long as you do not let it gnaw at the substance of your present. I have seen men consumed by their dreams, and it is a sour business. If you cling too tightly to a dream, a poodle bitch or a personal sausage chef or whatever, then you miss the felicity of your heart beating and the smell of the grass growing and the sounds lizards make when you run through the neighborhood with your friend. Your dream should be like a favorite old bone that you savor and cherish and chew upon gently. Then, rather than stealing from you a wasted sigh or the life of an idle hour, it nourishes you, and you become strangely contented by nostalgia for a possible future, so juicy with possibility and redolent of sautéed garlic and decadent slabs of bacon, that you feel full when you've eaten nothing. And then, one fine day, when the sun smiles upon your snout, when the time is right, you bite down hard. The dream is yours. And then, you chew on the next one. Oberon chuffed, his version of human laughter.
Suffering catch, Atticus. You're talking like I'm a twitchy Pomeranian, when I'm more emotionally stable than you are. And I'm not missing out on the lizards. I've heard 7 of them so far rustling around in the lantana bushes. They like the purple and yellow ones best, not so much the white. What I want to know is, where can I get a bone like that?
Chapter 6. Here's how you know someone has had a good idea. Other people freely admit to their friends that said idea has changed their lives. Most people today will grant that fire and the wheel are the big two. After that, any attempts to rank the greatest ideas of all time are going to draw lots of argument. You'll have zealots pimping this god or that on the one hand, scientists pimping Darwin on the other, and then practical people pointing at written language and saying, "Look, fellas, the reason those ideas have gone viral is because someone figured out how to write them down." On Saturday night, the day after my return from Asgard, I heard about a new life-changing invention, for some, the salad spinner.
"I seriously love my salad spinner," Granuel confided. "It's changed my life."
She said this in her kitchen, where she was busy making me the dinner she owed me, for guessing wrong about Ratatosk's size and the ability to enter Asgard via Yggdrasil. "Excuse me for just a moment," I said, and I exited the kitchen for the living room, where her laptop had access to Wi-Fi in the building. I googled, "Salad spinner changed my life," and got more than 6,000 hits. There was also a Salad Spinner Appreciation Society on Facebook. It wasn't what I'd call a cultural revolution, but it had potential, and I was willing to find out more. I returned to the kitchen and said, "Sorry about that. Please explain how your salad spinner has changed your life."
"Oh,"
Granuel's eyes flicked down, perhaps with a shade of embarrassment.
"Well, when you wash lettuce, it's tough to get the leaves dry without wasting paper towels and spending all your time patting them dry. If you just leave them wet, then your dressing dilutes and alters the taste you're aiming for. Oil and water don't mix, right? But now..."
And her voice deepened into a mockery of a nitro-funny car drag race commercial on the radio.
"I can use the raw, unbridled power of a salad spinner!"
Her voice rose at the end of the sentence in maniacal excitement. Her hand plunged down to the handle of her spinner, and she worked it furiously, continuing in the same frenzied voice. See the centrifugal force work its magic on the water! Red leaf, green leaf, spinach, or arugula, it doesn't matter! Just put your wet greens in the spinner and crank that mother till all the moisture's gone! Super dry salad!
Here Granuelle balled her fists at her sides and thrust her hips forward lewdly.
Get some!
That was when I lost it. Up to that point, my mouth was hanging open in shock. But when she whipped out the pelvic thrust for nothing more than a salad, well, that brought on an epic fit of the giggles. Her performance began looping in my mind's eye, and the absurdity of it kept tickling me so that I couldn't stop. Paroxysms shook me until I fell off my chair, and that made it worse. Tears came to my eyes, and I gasped for breath as I slapped the wood laminate of her floor. Granuelle's face turned bright red, and she sank down laughing too, laughing both at herself and at my reaction. Eventually, we got around to eating that salad, but not before our stomachs ached from extended merriment. It was succulence itself. Spinach and red leaf lettuce, tossed with jicama, white onion, mandarin oranges, and candied walnut pieces. The dressing was a homemade citrus vinaigrette. This, however, was merely a side. Chef Granuelle McTiernan set a broiled orange ruffy fillet on top of a wild rice pilaf, then placed on top of that a flash-broiled portobello mushroom that had been marinated in a Beaujolais red wine. Several spears of lightly salted asparagus, drizzled with olive oil, complemented the fish, and a bottle of Pinot Noir from the Santa Cruz Mountains did all those snooty and delicious things in our mouths that wine connoisseurs go on about.
"Outstanding," I said, chewing appreciatively. "Truly fantastic."
"I always settle accounts," Granuelle said,
and quirked an eyebrow at me. "That's good to know. I'm the same way. There are a lot of people who would like to settle accounts with me, however, and we should probably speak of it."
"All right," she said. She narrowed her eyes and pointed her fork at me, jabbing it forward to punctuate her words. "But if you're going to try to convince me to give up being a druid again, you can forget it."
I shook my head with a rueful grin. "You don't have all the information yet." She'd already heard about Ratatosk and Yggdrasil, and I'd shared the general look of the plane with her, but I hadn't explained what really happened other than that I'd successfully stolen an apple. Now, I recounted everything.
"So, Hugin and Moonin are looking for you right now?"
she asked after I'd finished. "As we speak, no doubt. The only reason they haven't found me already is that they don't know what to look for. But if Odin ever suspects it was a druid that slew the Norns and his favorite horsey, he'll make noise around Tir na n'og, and then they'll find me quickly, because everyone there knows where I am now. I have to move."
"Of course you do, but..."
Her face clouded.
"That means I have to move too."
"Right," I nodded. "And change your name, and cut off all contact with your family and friends to protect them. Unless you like having a family and friends. Then you should give up this dream of being a druid and live happily ever after." Granuelle slammed her fork down.
"Damn it, Sensei! I'm not giving that up, I told you!"
"How will your loved ones take this, Granuelle? Look at it from their perspective for a moment. To them, it's going to look like I've kidnapped you or that you've joined a cult."
"Well, kind of is a cult, isn't it?"
she joked. I chuckled. "I suppose. A very tiny one. Here we all are. You can shave your head if you like for verisimilitude." Granuelle's jaw dropped.
"I thought you liked my hair."
"Oh, damn," she'd noticed. "There's no winning this. Change the subject. You never answered my question. Aren't your parents going to worry? You won't be able to contact them often, if at all." She shrugged and puffed a soft dismissal past her lips.
"I don't talk to them much as it is. They're divorced. Dad is always on a dig somewhere in the cradle of civilization, and Mom is busy raising her new family in bloody Kansas.
The way she spat out Kansas led me to believe she did not consider it the cradle of civilization.
I let them know I wanted my independence early on, and they gave it to me.
They seem to have set you up well, I remarked, flicking my eyes around.
Oh yeah, how does a barmaid afford a condo like this, right? Well, it's paid for by dinosaurs. Mom's new husband is an oily oil man. So greasy, he looks like he sleeps in a jar of Vaseline. He has one clump of hair that he's grown really long, and he combs it over pathetically to try to cover up his shiny bald head. I despise him, and he loathes me. When I said I wanted to attend ASU, he was only too happy to pay all the bills, so long as I agreed to stay out here.
I sighed and closed my eyes. Clearly, she wasn't going to miss much of her old life. I'd gone and caught myself an ideal candidate for Druidry. Still, it was best to be thorough, and I still had a couple of disincentives to offer. Granuel, did I ever tell you what happened to my last apprentice?
No, but I think you're probably going to tell me he died horribly.
Tragically, yes. Cut down by Moors in the Kingdom of Galicia in 997. He was only a couple months away from getting his tattoos and becoming a full druid. He was utterly vulnerable, you see? Utterly defenseless. And that's what you're going to be for 12 more years. There aren't many shortcuts we can take. This isn't like the movies where you can just feel the force or learn everything you need to know in a 3-minute montage or those novels where the young hero masters advanced swordplay in a couple of months of lessons on the trail. And all that time, you'll be a target in a way I never was. In a way Chebron never was.
Chebron was your apprentice?
Yes. I trained him in secret. The locals all thought I was a staunch Christian, the rock of the neighborhood, and never suspected for a moment what I truly was. And back when I was in training, before Christianity, it was perfectly safe to be a druid. Best possible thing that could happen to a lad, in fact. But you're not in that situation. I'm currently a high-value target, and I'm going to be the gods most wanted after this next trip to Asgard, no matter how it turns out. If things don't go well, you're almost certainly going down with me. You could be throwing away your whole life. Granuel pressed her lips together and smiled tightly.
Nope, you're not scaring me away. Correct me if I'm wrong, but so far the score is Atticus 5, gods 0.
That's a poor analogy. If they score 1, I'm dead, and they win.
Whatever.
She held up a hand.
My point is that you kick ass, and it reminds me of something I've been meaning to ask you. How did the Romans ever manage to wipe out the druids? You can travel to different planes, camouflage yourselves, shapeshift, and fight without ever getting tired. So what happened?
Caesar and Minerva, I said. That's what happened. Granuel said nothing. She picked up her wine glass and took a sip, raising her eyebrows expectantly, waiting for me to elaborate. There was more to it than that, I admitted. I think there were vampires behind it, too. But what I know for certain is that Caesar tromped through Gaul, burning all the sacred groves, and that effectively prevented most druids from shifting planes and escaping easily. We didn't have the freedom to use any healthy forest we wanted at the time. That became my project afterward. The fires didn't simply burn the wood, you see. They burned away the tethers to Tir na n'Og. It left all the continental druids stranded here on this plain. Once that was accomplished, Minerva screwed us over by giving Roman scouts the ability to see through our camouflage, and then they could chase us down. The ability to fight without tiring doesn't help when a cohort of legionnaires surrounds you and thrust their spears from every direction. And that's what they did, make no mistake. It was a systematic slaughter. Some tried to fly away in their bird forms, but they were shot down by archers.
But surely some of you escaped.
Oh, aye. Druidry struggled on, especially in Ireland, because it was isolated from the Romans. But then St. Patrick came along, you know, spreading Catholicism. Lots of lads looked at 12 years of hard study and responsibility, weighted against the instant acceptance and fellowship of the Christians, and chose the easier faith. And then it was just a matter of attrition. None of the other druids knew the herb lore of Eremit, and they eventually died of old age, if the Romans didn't get them. And one day, the last druid except for me died without leaving behind a trained druid to take his place. I couldn't tell you precisely when it happened, but it was most likely the 6th or 7th century. Grognuel put down her glass and leaned forward.
But you should have destroyed them all. You had the power of the whole earth at your command. You see how things are bound together. Why couldn't you... you know?
She faltered, making lame gestures of something breaking apart with her hands. Go ahead and ask. Every initiate does at some point.
Well, can't you break the bonds holding together someone's aorta, for example? Or cause an aneurysm in the brain? Pull out all the iron in the blood?
I can't because of this, I said, holding up my tattooed right arm and pointing at it with my left hand. I know you can't read what these bindings mean yet, but there's a condition woven into these knots. As soon as you attempt to use any of the Earth's energy to directly harm or kill a living creature, any creature, mind you, not just a human, you're dead. The only reason the Earth grants druids her power is that we're pledged to protect her life. So if a rhino charges me, I'm not bursting its heart. I'm getting out of the way.
Grognuel stared at me. That makes no sense.
Of course it does.
You just told me how you bound the Norns together and chopped off their heads.
I bound their clothes together. They happened to be wearing them at the time. I performed no magic directly on their bodies. I killed them with my sword.
That's not protecting life.
I was protecting my own.
But you told me Engisog used magic to take over Fagles' mind.
She was referring to a binding placed on the Timpi police detective who'd shot me 6 weeks ago. Since the Tuatha De Danann were bound to the earth like me, they had to follow the same rule. He did, but that binding didn't directly harm Fagles. Fagles was killed by the Phoenix police.
But didn't he make Fagles shoot you? Wasn't that harming you?
The magic was directed at Fagles, not at me. And Fagles shot me with a completely ordinary, non-magical gun. Grognuel tapped her fingernail on the table.
These are really hair-thin distinctions.
Yes, and they're the sort that Angus Og knew very well.
Why bother making them? I mean, the Earth has to be aware that you're using her power to strengthen your sword arm, or make you jump higher, and so on.
Yes, I'm using the power to compete. To prove myself worthy of living another day. Competition, strife, and predation are natural and encouraged by the Earth. I still have to be smarter than the other guy, more skilled than the other guy to survive. I can't simply fix everything by melting people's brains.
Wait, you mess around with skin cells all the time. You give people wedgies by binding the cotton of their underwear with the skin high up on their backs. You started a slap fight between two cops in front of Saturn.
No damage was done. The skin never broke. No harm, no foul.
All right, then. What about the demons? You used cold fire on them.
They're not living creatures of the Earth. They're spirits from hell that take on a corporeal form here. But I have to warn you not to try anything standard on them. They are bound together differently than the flora and fauna of Earth, so no druidic magic works except for cold fire. It's better just to hack them up. That unbinds them from their corporeal form quite well. Grognuel puffed an errant lock of hair away from her face and then tucked it behind her ear, thinking through the implications.
Does this taboo extend to healing?
Not in so many words, but in practice, yes. Messing around with tissue and organs is vastly complicated. It's too easy to make a mistake and do more harm than good, and then you're dead. That's why I never go there with other people. I use magic to heal only myself, because there's no prohibition against screwing yourself up, and I know my body extremely well.
Ah, so that's why you only use herb lore for your healing.
I nodded. That's right. You can perform bindings on harvested plants and the chemicals in them all you want. It's slower than directly healing someone, but it's safer all around. You can't trespass against the prohibition to do no direct magical harm, and it keeps your abilities secret. If people wonder why your teas or poultices are so effective, you can plausibly point to your unique recipes or fresh ingredients or something else, and magic is never an issue.
Are you positive that you're the last druid alive today?
I waggled the flat of my hand in the air in a sort of kind of motion. The Tuatha De Danann are technically druids because they're all tattooed like I am. They can do whatever I can do, and then some. Best not to call them druids, though. They like to think of themselves as gods. I grinned sardonically. Druids are lesser beings, you see. But so far as such lesser beings are concerned, I do believe I'm the last one walking the earth. Unless you want to count all the happy, hippie neo-druids who do seem to love the earth but lack any real magic.
No, I meant druids like you.
Then there are none like me. Until you become one, if you live long enough.
I'll make it,
Granuel said.
You gave me this completely unsexy amulet to make sure I do.
She lifted a teardrop of cold iron strung on a gold chain out from her shirt. The Morrigan had given it to me, and I had passed it on to my apprentice. That's not going to save you all the time, I reminded her.
I know. It seems to me that the thing to do is to simply disappear.
No, they'll still look for us.
Who are they?
The remaining Norse and any other gods who want to make a point that you can't kill gods with impunity.
What if they think we're dead? Will they still be looking for us then?
I sighed and smiled contentedly. You're a constant relief to me, you know? Every time you say something smart, it gives me hope that you might become the first new druid in more than 1,000 years. Chapter 7. Moving sucks. Most people would nod and agree without question, but saying it that way leaves ample room for interpretation. How much does it suck? Well, it's not as bad as the stink behind a steakhouse. Nor is it comparable to the slow burn of heartache or the breathtaking agony of a swift kick to the groin. It's more like the secret existential horror I feel whenever I see gummy worms. I had a girlfriend in San Diego in the early 90s who noticed that I was profoundly unfamiliar with modern junk food. One day, as I dozed at the beach, she tested the boundaries of my ignorance by arranging an entire package of gummy worms across my body, assuring me when I opened an eye that these gelatinous cylinders were some sort of new spa treatment called sun straws with UV protection built in, and I gullibly accepted her explanation. I woke up with bright death trails of corn syrup crisscrossing my torso, silently and stickily accusing me of wormicide in the hot coastal sun. Even the mighty rinse cycle of the Pacific Ocean couldn't wash them away. They clung to me like soul-sucking leeches. She wasn't my girlfriend after that, and I moved out of San Diego that very night. It gets worse the longer you wait between moves, because you've had time to accumulate massive piles of crap, even if you try to minimize your consumption like I do. Looking around at more than a decade's worth of accreted stuff, I was glad this move would force me to leave it all behind. If I took anything with me, then they would know I'd scarpered off somewhere. Some of my best 20th century goodies were going to be let go, various bits of detritus saved from previous moves. My signed copy of the Beatles' White Album was going to stay behind. So were the Cherry Chewbacca action figures in the original packaging. I had a baseball signed by Randy Johnson when he was with the Diamondbacks, and a beer bottle that had once met the lips of Papa Hemingway. Most of the weapons in the garage would be left. All I would take was the bow and the quiver of arrows blessed by the Virgin Mary, because those could come in handy. Other than that, I'd take Fraggraw and Oberon and the clothes on my back, leaving everything else. The house was easy. The business was tough. If I was going to make it look like I planned on coming back, I had to keep it open. But I had only one remaining employee besides Granuel, Rebecca Dane, and I hated to leave her in charge of the store all by herself, especially since it was the first place my enemies would look for me. By the same token, they'd know I'd left town instead of croaked if I packed it up or sold it. I'd prefer they think me dead. No matter how I rationalized it, I couldn't help thinking that leaving Rebecca in the lurch would make me every bit the cock-knuckle Thor was reputed to be. Hiring someone new to help her would only increase my cock-knucklery. Added to this was the problem of my rare book collection. There were seriously dangerous tomes in there, protected by seriously dangerous wards. I couldn't leave either the books or the wards in place, but it had to appear as though the rare books were still there. Problems like that are why I like to have lawyers. They do all sorts of useful things for me and keep it secret under the attorney-client privilege. After going for a morning jog with Oberon and tuning the TV to Animal Planet for him, I met one of my attorneys, Hal Hawk, at a Tempe bagel joint called Chompy's. Hal ordered a bagel with lox, shudder, and I had a blueberry one with cream cheese. Hal looked very businesslike, his expression professionally bland, and his movements conservative and precise. He seemed to be slightly uncomfortable in his navy pinstriped suit, which was ridiculous because it was perfectly tailored. I knew that meant he was nervous. He hadn't behaved this way since I first moved into Tempe and the pack hadn't settled my status yet. It made me curious. Had my status changed somehow with the pack all of a sudden?
"What's got you all twitchy, Hal? Fess up."
Hal's eyes met mine sharply, and I watched with amusement as his shoulders visibly relaxed, but only with a conscious effort.
"I am not the least bit twitchy. Your characterization is scurrilous and unfounded. I haven't twitched once in the 2 minutes we've been here."
"I know, and the effort at locking it down is going to give you indigestion. Why don't you just tell me what's bothering you so you can get it out of your system and relax?" Hal regarded me in stony silence for a few seconds, then his fingers began drumming in sequence on the tabletop. He was worked up all right. But when he spoke, I could barely hear him.
"I don't want to be Alpha."
"You don't want to be Alpha?" I said. "Well, then your dreams have come true. You're not. Gunnar is Alpha, and you're doggy number 2.
"But Gunnar is going with you to Asgard."
I blinked.
"He is?"
Hal dipped his chin in the barest of nods.
"It was decided last night. Leaf talked him into it. I'm to be Alpha until he returns, and if he doesn't, well then I'm doomed."
"Wahaha! Cue the derisive laughter. You can't be top dog and tell me you're doomed, Hal. Nobody's going to buy that."
"I like being Gunnar's second," Hal groused. "I don't want to make those decisions, and there will be plenty to make if he doesn't come back. Scores more if Leaf doesn't come back."
"How is Leaf anyway? Is that finger fully grown back?" Leaf had lost his finger, and nearly his undead existence, in the fight with Detoctor Destritten Houses, when they managed to torch his combustible flesh.
"Yeah, it's fine, and he's coming to see you tonight along with Gunnar."
"Good. What's the problem with Leaf not coming back?"
"We'll have the bloodiest vamp war in centuries if he's gone more than a month. They're already sniffing around."
"I beg your pardon?"
"The vampires. They want his territory."
"The bloodiest vamp war in history will be fought over Tempe?" Hal stared at me to gauge whether I was being serious or not.
"His territory is a whole lot bigger than Tempe, Atticus. You can't tell me you didn't know."
"Well, yes, I can. Leaf and I never talked about his territory because I'm not interested and he's not a braggart. I know that Leaf must be in singular control of Tempe because I've never seen or smelled another vampire in the city, but I don't know how he could realistically hold any more." Hal snorted and held his face in his hands. He peered at me from between his fingers.
"Atticus, Leaf controls the entire state of Arizona.
all by himself. He's the baddest of badass vampires. He's the oldest thing walking around this hemisphere, besides you and the native gods.
He dropped his hands and tilted his head at me like a curious canine.
You honestly didn't know that?
Nope. Why would I care? I'm not a vampire, and I don't want his territory. You don't want the whole state for your pack either, am I right?
Well, no, but you have to appreciate what's going to happen here.
No, I don't. I'm moving.
Wherever you move, it's going to be felt. This kind of power vacuum is going to bring every wannabe vamp lord down on the state, all wanting to carve out a piece of it for themselves. And they're going to leave other power vacuums behind them when they go. If Leaf doesn't come back, the ripples are going to be felt all over the country, I can guarantee it, and in quite a few other countries besides.
Well, what do you want me to do about it?
Make damn sure both Gunnar and Leaf come back. That way I don't have to be Alpha, and I don't have to worry about fighting off a bunch of bloodsuckers.
I can't believe Leaf is so feared. He's a perfectly reasonable guy.
To you and me, yes, he is. He works very well with us. But he's absolute hell on other vampires, from what I understand. They're scared of him, and with good reason. You know, he shouldn't have survived getting burned like that.
I crinkled my brows. No? Why not?
That wasn't a normal fire where you could just stop, drop, and roll. That was hellfire, Atticus. It's almost impossible to put out. It would have destroyed any other vampire I've ever heard of.
Silence fell as I considered this. A vampire war would indeed be inconvenient for everyone, but I didn't see how I could prevent it on top of everything else I had to do. I was also able to conclude to my satisfaction that it wasn't really my problem anyway. Hal said into the silence,
"Let's proceed to business, shall we?"
"Yeah, let's." Hal put his briefcase up on the table and took out a legal pad. I told him what I needed. Approximately 300 semi-rare books, nothing remarkable, just old, delivered by FedEx tomorrow morning. I also needed the firm to draw up paperwork to handle the sale of the store to Rebecca Dane after 3 months for $1.72.
"Why the 72 cents?"
Hal wondered aloud. "Because everyone who looks at the deal will ask the same question. I want Detective Geffert to think it's a significant clue. I hope he builds a conspiracy theory around it, but it's purely there to mess with his mind and waste his time." Hal shrugged and wrote it down. I also arranged for the firm to provide 3 months' pay to Rebecca and any additional employees she should choose to hire on her own. I'll let her know that she is to manage the place and to let anyone who inquires know that I have gone on an extended vacation to the Antipodes. Hal raised his eyebrows but made no comment. I'd brought a parcel to the restaurant, and it rested next to me on the vinyl material of the booth seat. Now I hefted it onto the table and untied the string around it before removing the top. A truly rare book lay inside in a nest of tissue paper. The green cloth covered with gilt lettering and blind embossed leaves finally got a reaction from Hal.
"Is that a first edition?" he asked.
"Uh-huh. Extremely rare copy of Whitman's Leaves of Grass. It should fetch at least 150 grand, probably much more. This goes to Rebecca Dane once she's bought the store, not before." I replaced the box lid, and Hal stared at the book cover until it disappeared from view.
"All right."
He shook his head to clear it and get back to business.
"What else?"
"I'll need new IDs for myself and my apprentice. Pick some random Irish names."
"All right. Email me some pictures. Where's she going to be while you're gone?"
"She'll stick around for a couple days, then move to a secure, undisclosed location." Hal looked up at my choice of words. "No, the Vice President won't be there."
"All right. Is that all?"
"Almost. Granuel is to contact you after 3 months if she doesn't hear from me by then. You're to assume I'm dead if she contacts you in that case." I really hoped this wouldn't be necessary, but it was best to plan for the worst. I'll need Oberon to be looked after, preferably by Granuaile, and I need to set up a trust for her now. We worked out the details of that, and then Hal said,
I have some news to share with you. You recall that we set an investigator on the trail of this group calling themselves the Hammers of God?
Yes.
The investigator's missing. Presumed dead.
Are we also presuming that the rabbi is returning with reinforcements? The rabbi Yosef Bialik had been convinced to leave town without harm, but I'd always assumed he'd be back.
Yes. Everyone in the pack will shortly be wearing a thin body armor underneath their clothes. Should be good enough to stop a thrown silver knife.
They enchant the handles too, so I'd suggest gloves. The idea is to hit you again when you try to pull the knife out. Hal shrugged.
Magic doesn't scare me. Only silver.
I wondered what it would be like to be scared of only one thing. After breakfast with Hal, I went to the shop and met Rebecca Dane there. I made her day by telling her she was getting a promotion and a raise, then spent the morning reviewing how to run the shop all by herself. She wouldn't be able to make some of the more complicated teas that required the use of binding, but all the straight herbal stuff was well within her compass, including Mobility, my bestseller for arthritic customers. You can hire some help if you like. I'm going away for a while, and so is Granuaile. We are going on an archaeological dig in the Antipodes.
Oh,
she said, a faint wrinkle of concern appearing between her eyes.
For how long?
It might be months.
It would certainly be months. Years.
I prepared her for it as best as I could, explaining that the law firm of Magnuson and Hawk would be paying her and keeping in touch. She was excited and flushed with the responsibility. She was fresh and affable, and my regulars liked her. She radiated innocence and served people without a trace of guile or condescension.
I hoped that would be enough to save her when people came looking for me and realized that she knew nothing.
My lunch date was Malina Sokowowski, the leader of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. We met in Four Peaks Brewery on 8th Street. She was wearing the same red wool coat she'd worn the first time we met almost 2 months ago. Her blonde hair lay upon her shoulders like a rich nude woman on a divan, sleek and shiny and unapologetically decadent. I felt the eyes of envious men boring into my back as she favored me with a brilliant smile of welcome and a pleased purring of my name. It was strange to think that I had made peace with a coven of witches, but I had to admit that Melina's crew was different. Though they still took advantage of people and were always, always plotting to exert some sort of control over others, they at least had pretensions of being good citizens otherwise. We had fought side by side and recognized that there was a patch of common ground between us, a sliver of ellipsoid and a Venn diagram of a witch and a druid where we could meet, and pretend that the vast area of the spheres behind us was undiscovered country rather than our comfort zone. We spoke of small things at first. She inquired after Granuaile and Oberon. I inquired after her coven sisters. Our drafts came. I had a kilt lifter, and she was drinking the Sunbrew Kolsch. We toasted healthy alliances and sighed appreciatively as we set our glasses down.
Beer like that almost makes me forget the incredible danger we're in,
Melina said.
I beg your pardon? I mean, yeah, the beer's good, but
what danger?
We've been continuing our divination rituals because we're unconvinced that we've seen the last of the Hammers of God. From what we can tell, the rabbi is definitely coming back with more Kabbalists just like him. But that's not all,
Melina said.
Something else is on the horizon. Several somethings. I think one of them is Bacchus. He might be coming here to look for you.
This wasn't a surprise between what I'd done to his Bacchus in Scottsdale and the blame I'd laid at his door while I was in Asgard. How soon?
Tomorrow at the earliest, if I'm reading things right.
That was a surprise.
Gods below! I cursed. I don't have time to deal with that.
time, Melina spluttered.
What about the strength? You can't take on one of the Olympians.
I seem to remember you doubting I could take on Angus Og, I teased her. Have I not earned at least a fighting chance against Bacchus? But that's assuming I'd want to fight him, and I don't. What else did you see?
Many vampires.
If I needed any confirmation that Hal was right about the vampire war, this was it.
Here goes the recovery of Mr. Helgerson.
Absolutely peachy, as far as I know. I'm supposed to see him tonight, but look, between your coven and me, he's leaving tomorrow. Melina's lips tightened.
Leaving for good?
I shrugged. That's my assumption. This place will be crawling with would-be replacements before long. Melina grimaced and muttered something in Polish that I guessed was a curse. By the way, I'm leaving too. Her eyes widened, and the Polish cursing became more vehement. Plus, Gunnar Magnusson. She didn't have words to express her shock at that. Why would an alpha ever leave his pack?
What is going on?
She breathed. I can't tell you, but what I respectfully suggest to you, as an ally, is to get yourself out of here. The Hammers of God are coming for you every bit as much as they're coming for me, and you don't want to be around when the Vamp War begins. Whoever comes out on top is probably not going to ignore your coven like Leaf did.
No, it's for certain,
Melina said, and took a long pull on her beer for courage.
I think your advice is good, and we should pursue it, but I don't know where to go. We were counting on this area remaining stable.
The era of stability is already gone. This city is about to pass through the Valley of the Shadow of Deep Shit. Best to cut and run while you still can.
Is that what you're doing? Running?
I suppose I'm running from one fight to take part in another. Characterize it however you wish. Look, just pack all your crap into a U-Haul tonight and get out of the state. Stash everything in a storage facility and then take your time finding someplace else to settle down.
You've done this sort of thing before, I take it.
Absolutely. Works great. But if you don't like that idea, how about rebuilding your coven? Go back to Poland, pick up some new recruits, take the long view here instead of focusing on short-term losses. That's how you survive.
That sounds like a very good idea. I don't know if we can get out of here quickly enough, though. We have significant assets tied up here.
Hand them over to Magnusson and Hawk. Let them liquidate everything and put the proceeds in an offshore account for you. They can also get you new IDs if you need them, and I'd suggest it since the Hammers of God have probably done their homework.
You advise me well.
Aw, shucks. Melina beamed at me for a sunlit time, and then her smile faded as she processed that this leave-taking would probably be our last for a long while.
Will our paths ever cross again?
She asked. Perhaps, but not for at least a decade. I'm going to fall off the map if I survive what's coming.
But you won't share with me what's coming?
No, safer if you don't know. Safest to just get out of this place and begin again. She nodded her understanding and said,
Well, our short acquaintance has been most instructive. On the one hand, you're responsible for wiping out half my coven, and on the other, you're largely responsible for preserving the lives of those who remain. You were forced into defending yourself in the first place, but you had no obligation to help us in the second. I must conclude that druids are dangerous, but fairly amenable acquaintances, though my sample size is admittedly very small.
She smiled.
Whatever you're about to undertake, I hope you'll survive and manage to find us in the future. If we know you're coming, Bertha will bake you a cake.
Thank you. Is there any place in particular I should look for you? I'd like to learn how to speak with a proper Polish accent. She slung a smirk at me and said,
It's safer if you don't know.
Chapter 8 Since this was to be the last night I spent in Arizona, I was hoping that I'd be able to get a full night's rest. It's funny how vampires don't respect that, since they always expect you to let them sleep all day. After spending the afternoon reviewing tea recipes with Rebecca Dane one last time, and hooking her up with herb vendors for resupply, I spent an hour at my kitchen table drawing a map of Asgard based on my observations and Ratatosk's intelligence. Then I went for a run with Oberon in the early twilight of late autumn, and returned after sundown to a well-dressed vampire waiting on my front porch. He had an impeccably tailored werewolf sitting next to him. Normally, the two don't mix, but Leif Helgerson and Gunnar Magnusson had several common bonds. They were both lawyers, they were both originally from Iceland, and they both hated Thor. They got along just fine, but I didn't think they were bosom buddies. They'd driven to my house separately, probably because each was too dominant to let anyone else drive. Leif's black Jaguar XK convertible sat in front of Gunnar's silver BMW Z4 convertible. Most of the Tempe pack drove those, but I'd never asked them why they chose such tiny cars.
"Oh, look, it's a dead guy and a wet dog," Oberon said as we stopped jogging in front of my lawn.
In the dim glow of the streetlights, Leif and Gunnar rose to meet us, shoving their hands in their pockets to reveal their competing vests, or waistcoats, as they probably thought of them. Leif's was a Victorian burgundy number with matte black satin lining and 8 black buttons in 2 columns of 4. He'd gone all the way and had a gold chain wrapped around them leading to a pocket watch. He was even wearing one of those old-fashioned black string ties. Except for the straight pale corn silk hair and the lack of mustache, he looked like he'd stepped out of the pages of a steampunk novel. And what's more, he didn't look the least bit scorched from his encounter with Hellfire. Gunnar's suit was likewise old-fashioned, but it was gray and silver. His waistcoat was a decadently patterned silver paisley on a cool gray material, lined in gunmetal satin. His tie was the more modern sort, black with a silver paisley design, and he too had a gold pocket watch. His hair was a darker blonde, much more of a tawny lion's mane, and he'd slicked it back around the sides and let it curl on top. He had thick mutton chops that stopped short of his chin and arced over his upper lip. The choice of colors for his wardrobe seemed odd for a werewolf, until I realized that it was a status thing, like everything else with members of the pack. As Alpha, he couldn't show fear of silver, so of course he drove a silver car and wore silver clothes whenever he could. Now that I thought about it, I'd never seen Hal wear silver. He drove a metallic blue car, but that was it. If he wound up being Alpha, he'd have to get a whole new wardrobe.
"This guy doesn't have that citrus smell that Hal always does," Oberon observed. "He's letting his inner dog hang out. I approve."
"Good evening, Atticus," Leif said in his stilted speech.
"Atticus,"
Gunnar acknowledged me with a gruff nod. There was some tension between us and always had been, though none of it came from me. I liked Gunnar just fine. His problem was that he didn't know if he could take me in a fight, and neither did his wolves. Since I was also a shapeshifter and centuries older than he was, they might follow me as an alpha if circumstances were right. Gunnar wanted to make sure those circumstances never occurred. He had declared me a friend of the pack years ago, and then done everything he could to avoid me so that his wolves would have few occasions to compare us side by side. We'd always been cordial to each other, but some of that cordiality had chilled after he lost 2 pack members in the Superstition Mountains while trying to rescue Hal, who'd been drawn into the fight only because of me. "Good evening, gentlemen," I said, nodding to each of them in return. "I'm honored by your visit. May I invite you inside for a beer and some blood?" I gave Leif a goblet full of my blood every so often, and now I wondered if that had something to do with him surviving an attack he shouldn't have survived. They made noises of graciousness and gave Oberon a friendly scratch or two behind his ears, and then we all went inside. I got a couple of bottles of Amagong's Three Philosophers Ale out of the fridge for Gunnar and me. Then I grabbed a goblet out of the cupboard and a steak knife out of the cutlery drawer and stabbed myself in the arm, allowing the blood to drip freely into the goblet. A small exertion of power shut down the pain. "I'm told by others that you've recovered fully, Leif," I remarked. "What's your own assessment?"
"Snorri has practically glutted me on bags of donated blood,"
he replied, referring to the werewolf doctor who worked in a Scottsdale hospital.
"And while it has been nourishing, it has also been less than satisfying. There is never the heady aroma of fear or the succulent scent of desire when you feast on a blood bag. Plus, they were refrigerated,"
he added with a shudder. "This should be pleasant, then," I said, watching the level of blood rise in the glass. "Though I'm afraid I can't help you with the smells of fear or desire. Would you say that you're as strong as ever, then?"
"Not precisely," Leif said. "Your blood helps tremendously, however. There is something about it, as we have discussed in the past."
"Yes, I'd be curious to know precisely what it is," I said. The goblet was nearly full, so I bound my torn tissue and skin back together to cut off the flow. "You're welcome to as much as I can afford, of course, in the coming days. I owe you at least that much, since you came to such harm on my account." I wiped a couple of stray drops off my arm with a washcloth, and then handed him the goblet. He thanked me and said,
"Helping me kill Thor will settle that account quite nicely."
"The same goes for me," Gunnar chimed in. Presumably he was referring to his dead pack members, but they had come to the superstitions on their own. I'd never asked them to come. If their deaths were on anyone's head, it was Gunnar's, but I let the comment slide.
If he'd consider his imaginary account settled by something I was already going to do anyway, there was no need to dispute him. "A toast, then," I said, raising my bottle. "Perhaps one of you should offer it, since you have stronger feelings on the matter than I do." My feelings were that I'd already done more than enough damage on the Norse plain. Leif and Gunnar spoke at once, as though they'd rehearsed it in stereo.
"To killing Thor!"
I think one or both of them spit on me in the process. Their vehemence was so strong.
"Hear, hear," I said, attempting to sound hearty about it, and we all clinked our drinks and drank deeply.
Leif looked visibly healthier almost immediately.
"It's times like these I wish I had opposable thumbs," Oberon said. "I can't participate in drinking rituals without making loud lapping noises."
"Would you like a treat as a consolation prize?"
"That would console me considerably."
I gave Oberon a treat from the pantry and said to my guests, "So, have you come to play video games? Maybe kick it old school with a few rounds of Yahtzee?"
"In happier times, perhaps," Leif said dryly. "I rather hoped we could discuss details of our trip to Asgard."
"By all means, please, be seated." I waved at my kitchen table, and we all took seats. The map I'd drawn earlier was still there, lying face up. I turned it over so that it wouldn't distract them. I'd show it to them a bit later. "May I ask who else is coming besides Gunnar?" Leif steepled his fingers together, elbows on the table, and peered at me from one side of them.
"Of course. There are three additional parties joining us. They await only the location of our rendezvous and a meeting time."
"I can give you GPS coordinates. Will that suffice?"
"Admirably."
"Who are these three other parties?"
Gunnar demanded. I think Leif had been about to say their names anyway, but he hadn't spoken up quickly enough for the werewolf. If Leif was irritated, he disguised it well.
"Perrin, a Slavic thunder god. Vainamoinen, a shamanic culture hero of the ancient Fens, and Zheng Guolao, one of China's eight immortals."
"I like that last guy's name,"
Oberon said.
"Who would win in a cage match between him and Pei Mei?"
He situated himself on the floor by my feet, and I caressed his neck. "Zheng Guolao, of course.
He's alive and Pei Mei is dead.
Pei Mei died in like 6 different movies, so he's obviously capable of coming back to life. He's had plenty of time to recover from those poisoned fish heads Daryl Hannah gave him in Kill Bill 2. He's probably on Facebook right now. Look him up.
That's it? The Alpha asked. 6 of us against all of Asgard.
Gunnar was used to having more than 6 with him on even the most routine hunts.
I don't care about all of Asgard, Leif explained. I only care about Thor.
Leif had the opposite problem. He'd been fighting alone for so long and shredding everything that he probably thought the 6 of us would be overkill. All of Asgard is going to object, I pointed out, and they have resources we need to address.
Such as?
Leif asked. I explained to them what I'd seen while stealing the Golden Apple. Thor's chariot, Gudel and Burste, the ravens Hugin and Munin, and 12 pissed-off Valkyries, plus Odin and all the rest of the gods. Not to mention the possibility of calling up the Einherjar, the fallen Vikings who dwell in Valhalla.
The Einherjar fight every day, preparing for Ragnarok, Gunnar mused. They are slain and raised again each day on the field of Vigrid. They have no fear of death, and their numbers must be huge. They're the perfect army. My friends, we are good, but not that good.
We will not have to face the Einherjar right away, I assured them. It's just a late-game possibility. The faster we are in attracting attention, the smaller the possibility that the Einherjar will be a problem.
How do you know this?
Leif said. I turned over the map I had made earlier and showed it to them. This is a map of the plain, which I know to be at least partially accurate, I said. We are going to emerge from the root of Yggdrasil. But see here, the field of Vigrid and Valhalla are on the opposite side of the plain, according to my source. Ratatosk had told me that and more during our trip up the route from Jotunheim.
Who's your source?
Gunnar asked. Well, he was a squirrel.
A squirrel? The Alpha spluttered. You can't trust a squirrel.
I'm with the werewolf on this one. Squirrels are dodgy,
Oberon said. Look, his information saved me a lot of trouble. He was very accurate about what I could independently verify. There's no reason to believe the rest of it is wildly off-kilter. If we can get Thor to come out and engage us somewhere on the plain of Idavol, the closer to Yggdrasil the better, the Einherjar will not be able to mobilize in time to make any difference. They don't have flying horses like the Valkyries. They'll have to march the whole way, and it will take them days.
Yes, I see, Leif said. But how do we get Thor to come out? Won't he simply sit behind the walls of Gladsheim or Bielskirnir and wait for us to come to him?
Nah, all we gotta do is ridicule his strength or say something about his mom. He's a bully, right? Bullies don't fight wisely.
Come now, Atticus, Leif said. How will he know we are even there, much less respond to a shouted taunt about his dubious parentage?
Oh, he'll know all right, I said. I have a plan, though in its current form it doesn't take into account the abilities of the other members of our party.
Let's hear it,
Gunnar said, and Leif seconded the motion. I told them what I'd been cooking up, and they approved everything but the rubber suits and the climbing gear.
We will not be needing those, trust me, Leif said. So, when is this going to happen?
We leave tomorrow night. Leif looked pleased at this news, but Gunnar seemed less than sanguine.
Must it be so soon?
The werewolf asked. The hammers of God plus an actual god are coming to slay me, so yes, it must be. I'd rather be a slayer than the slain. Gunnar looked at Leif.
That moves up your timetable significantly.
Yes, but not impossibly, the vampire replied. Especially if the druid helps.
What are you talking about? This was the part where we were supposed to wish each other good night and meet back here tomorrow at the same bat time. They sounded like they needed me for something else. Leaf turned his ice-blue eyes on me and allowed a small smile to tug at the edges of his mouth.
Territory, naturally.
Ah, yes. Hal mentioned to me earlier that you control the entire state. Congratulations. Leaf didn't answer, and Gunnar took the opportunity to jump in.
Yes, well, word of his injuries has spread, and some vampires have come to investigate.
I've heard, I said. Why don't you serve him up a cease and desist letter? You guys are good at that.
That is not how I respond to vampires in my territory,
Leaf said without humor. How do you respond, then?
I destroy them.
Oberon spoke up.
Now see, you can't just drop a line like that without a little something extra. He should get Danny Elfman to compose a chilling soundtrack especially for him, so that when he says macho stuff, he can play it back on one of those personal recorders and give the moment its proper melodrama. Or at least he could give us a...
It's difficult not to laugh when Oberon provides commentary like that, but I enjoy the challenge. It keeps me sharp. If I laughed or seemed the least bit amused, Leaf would probably not take it well. And if he realized my dog was making fun of him, he'd be sure to take offense. So, I carefully kept my expression neutral and said to Leaf, I see. And you'd like my help? As in tonight?
Yes.
That was precisely what I'd been afraid of. I sighed and said, Leaf, I need my sleep tonight, because I have a full day tomorrow and a long night after that getting us to Russia. I can't afford to tax myself tonight if you want to make it to Asgard. Your territorial concerns will have to remain your concerns. I'm sorry.
There are 63 vampires from Memphis at the Arizona Cardinals game right now,
Leaf said, tapping the table with his index finger.
I could use someone to watch my back.
How do you know they are there? Leaf ignored this and answered with another question.
Can I count on you, Atticus?
Only to get some sleep. How do you know about the vampires? My persistence didn't pay off. He ignored me again and turned to Gunnar to ask him to come. Whenever I asked Leaf a question about vampire hoodoo that he wanted to keep secret, he always pretended not to hear. Several months ago, I had used this to my advantage. I'd taken him to his first baseball game ever, on a mild June night with the roof open at Chase Field, as the Diamondbacks hosted the Padres. I'd known Leaf would be curious about the game and the behavior of people in such a crowd, but his questions never ended. If the team mascot was supposed to be a rattlesnake, why was there a bobcat named Baxter running around acting like an idiot? Did this mascot bait and switch indicate humanity's primeval fear of fanged creatures? Why do ballplayers seem to have oral fixations on gum, tobacco, or sunflower seeds? And why do some ballplayers feel the need to fondle their groin between every pitch? Is that why they're called ballplayers instead of athletes or competitors or contestants? It finally came to be too much, and I asked him a question I'd always wondered about. Hey, Leaf, I've been meaning to ask. There's this famous kids' book called Everyone Poops. Does that include vampires, since you guys are on a strict liquid diet? I'd imagine the accumulation of hemoglobin could really get you backed up after a while. Is there a special laxative you use, or what? Leaf regarded me glacially for a couple of heartbeats, then rose silently from his seat and shuffled past people to the aisle leading to the main concourse. Hey, give me a beer while you're up, I called. And a hot dog with mustard and onions. I didn't see him again for 3 innings, but he came back with a dog and a beer for me. Gunnar begged off back-watching duty. He had plenty to accomplish himself if he was to have all in order by tomorrow night.
I must arrange things satisfactorily with the pack, he said. Can't be helped.
Leaf gave up on the werewolf, but turned once more to me.
Atticus, you must help. Sleep is an insufficient excuse to stay home when there are so many vampires out there.
Is he serious? Sleep is the best excuse to stay home when there are vampires out there.
Don't get me wrong, Leaf, I said. I loves me some vampire hunting. Nothing like watching a hissing head go flying in one direction while the body falls in another, you know? But trust me when I say that taking the three of us to Tir na n'og is going to be taxing. You don't want me to be exhausted when I do that.
You never get tired, Leaf pointed out. You draw strength from the earth.
You're supposed to say gotcha when you catch people in verbal inconsistencies.
I am aware, but it sounds vulgar.
Perhaps it does. This isn't a gotcha moment, anyway. I'm speaking of mental exhaustion, not physical. Plain walking isn't a physical strain. It's a mental one. If I'm not fresh, then...
Say no more, Leaf interrupted. I understand. I will simply have to kill them all myself.
There he goes again. I'm telling you, Danny Elfman would love to get hold of those lines.
Not John Williams?
If you've got some hopelessly overmatched heroes fighting evil and some Imperial types marching, John Williams is your guy. You need the song to make people reach for a box of Kleenex. Talk to Wandy Newman. But if you want creepy atmospherics and spine-shivering chords to back up your casual death threats, you gotta bring in Danny Elfman.
Gunnar excused himself from the conversation and rose to leave, citing his pack business. We stood and shook hands and bid him good evening. He exited in a flash of silver, and I sat back down with Leaf. So, what's going to happen when you show up there, Leaf? Do all of the southern vampires know what you look like and have little posters of you taped to the inside of their coffins? Are they going to squee and ask for your autograph?
I beg your pardon? What was that? Will they screech and ask me?
No, I said squee.
I'm not familiar with this verb.
It's a relatively new exclamation. It's a high-pitched noise of excitement one makes when confronted with the celebrity one worships. Leaf took a moment to digest this, and then he arched a blonde eyebrow at me.
Tell me, Atticus, have you ever, squeed? Did I conjugate that correctly?
Yes, you did, and yes, as a matter of fact, I have squeed.
Do tell.
I went to the San Diego Comic-Con a few years back and met one of my favorite authors, and he made me squee involuntarily. I also did a tiny dance, and I might have peed a little bit when he shook my hand.
You did not,
Leaf stated flatly.
Liar,
Oberon added. Okay, maybe I didn't pee, but I spake truth about the tiny dance, or I'm the son of a goat. Authors aren't huge celebrities to most people, but I'm a guy who appreciates a good story well told. Beyond that, though, I think this man might actually possess supernatural powers. He makes people lose their minds, and I'm sure some of them do lose bladder control as well.
I see. And who is this author?
Neil fucking Gaiman.
His second name is fucking?
No, Leaf, that's the honorary second name all celebrities are given by their fans. It's not an insult, it's a huge compliment, and he's earned it. You'd like him. He dresses all in black like you. Read a couple of his books, and then when you meet him, you'll squee too. Leaf found the suggestion distasteful.
I would never behave with so little dignity, nor would I wish to be confronted in such a manner by anyone else. Vampires inspire screams, not squees. Involuntary urination is common, I grant, but it properly flows from a sense of terror, not an ecstatic sense of hero worship.
It properly flows? Are we having a pee pun party? A slight tightening around the eyes was my only visual clue that Leaf was amused. Otherwise, his face remained impassive, and his voice deadpanned.
If I do not aim carefully at my targets tonight, I might cause a big splash at the stadium.
Ah, very punny. You will show them what yellow cowards they are, I said,
right after I flush them out of the crowd.
You will rain down upon their porcelain skin a deluge of justice. Oh,
and I will have to wash my hands afterward.
I chuckled, and Leif's face finally cracked into a grin. It felt good to laugh, but then I wanted to ask Leif if vampires ever peed. Since he'd never answer that, I asked him something else. Leif, why is the Memphis Nest at the stadium?
It's a direct challenge to me. They are symbolically laying claim to all those people.
If you take them on during the game, there's likely to be collateral damage.
Leif nodded. They're counting on it.
That you won't want to hurt innocents?
No, that I will not want to cause a scene and leave a bunch of dead vampires lying around with a bunch of dead humans, thus exposing the secret of our existence. But they have miscalculated. I do not care about that anymore. I do want to cause a scene. Leaving the stadium littered with undead corpses will doubtlessly make the news. It will let everyone know I am still around and very capable of holding this territory.
And it will also let everyone know that vampires are real. Isn't that kind of a fatal flaw in your plan? Leif dismissed the point with a wave of his hand.
They will never admit the possibility. Science is so very sacred to them now, and scientifically vampires cannot exist, therefore we do not. Vampires are safe by this tautology alone. Any lab results they find outside the norm will be assumed to be contaminated.
Do you know if these Memphis vampires are very old? Leif snorted contemptuously.
I am the oldest vampire on this side of the Atlantic.
And on the other side? The blue ice of his eyes slid coolly from contemplating his empty goblet and regarded me.
The one who created me is still there, and there are others.
Any of them older than me? I asked brightly.
There is one I know of. There may be others. I have never met him, mind. I have heard of him only, but I am told he still hunts.
I half expected him to throw back his head and let rip with a shrill, hoarse cackle worthy of the Crypt Keeper, but he chose instead to remain silent and let the tension build. I think you're right, I told Oberon. He needs a soundtrack.
Hound One, Druid Zero.
Do you dare speak his name?
I whispered softly. Leif rolled his eyes, acknowledging my mockery.
He is called Theophilus.
Ha! I barked, amused by the Greek roots of his name. There's an ancient vampire in Europe whose name means loved by God?
I did not say he was in Europe, but yes, that is the name he professes to the world. I do not know if that is his original name, or if he is merely being ironic.
What's the name of the vampire who created you? The vampire narrowed his eyes.
Why do you wish to know?
I shrugged. Curiosity. Keeping his eyes on me to gauge my reaction, he carefully pronounced,
Zdenek.
That doesn't sound like an Icelandic name, I observed.
Your sharp ears serve you well. It is a Czech name.
My eyebrows shot up. You were turned by a Czech vampire in Iceland 1,000 years ago?
I never said I was turned in Iceland,
Leif replied, smirking. I frowned and reviewed our relationship, realizing that I'd been operating on an assumption all this time. Touché, I said. Will I ever get to hear the story of how and where you were turned? His smirk disappeared.
Perhaps someday. For now, I have some havoc to wreak and territory to defend.
He stood up and offered me his hand. I stood as well to shake it, and he shrugged diffidently as he said,
There are only 80 of the young ones scattered about the valley, and most of them are at the football game. See you tomorrow night, Atticus.
Heh, only 80. That was his way of saying he craps bigger than you.
I don't think vampires poop, I replied.
Nonsense! Everyone poops!
We saw Leif to the door and wished him farewell. Time to hit the hay for the last time in this old house, I told my hound as I closed the door on the vampire.
Cool. Can we watch one last movie first?
All right, buddy. What'll it be?
I think The Boondock Saints, because the Irish guys win. Plus, the cat ends badly. It affirms my worldview, and I feel validated.